Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Cult of Gracie Radio, which is broadcasting on XXBN, which uses blogtalkradio.com to broadcast and record. XXBN is a media project of Swap East, which is a sex worker outreach project organized in Raleigh, North Carolina. I am Gracie Bissett, and I'm in Fargo, North Dakota. Tonight we have a very special guest, Jennifer Cody Epstein, author of Painter from Shanghai. It's a novel based on the life of a real woman, a painter named Pan, and I hope I get this name right, Yulang?
Yulang.
Yeah. Oh, there's, thank you, Jennifer. she, a Chinese woman who was, if I'm remembering correct, because it's a fascinating book and lots of details to get, you know, like any person or character to get caught up in. She was 14 years old. She was orphaned. She was living with her uncle, and he sold her into prostitution. Correct?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then it's her life in and out and in into the art world. And it's a fascinating story. I guess I should say welcome to the show, Jennifer, before I start asking you questions. So
Thank
welcome.
You very much, but ask ahead. Ask ahead.
Well, I'll be honest, I haven't made it all the way through the book. We've had a personal tragedy here at Cult of Gracie. One of our Sex Kitten staff writers, Jewel, just passed away yesterday.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
We've had a choppy week here.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. But she was a fantastic editor and writer, and she would have loved this book. So that's why I didn't cancel the show, is because it's something she liked, and especially when it came with written word. So I haven't finished all the way, but I read enough of the book to know the style, and the writing is excellent. And you have to stop and remind yourself that this is not fiction, and you know, completely. This isn't some woman that you created in your head, that some character that had to get out. This was, you know, based on events from a real woman's life. And at other times, I have to stop myself and go, well, I don't know if that's always true, because it's not a strict biography.
Right.
So it's a real interesting read for myself, because I do read a lot of biographies. So I have to keep telling myself, well, I don't know that incident, you know, when how she felt when she went to the brothel house, you know, they're certainly honest and reasonable enough emotions, but I mean, I don't know that the things happened this way or that way, you know?
Right.
But at the same time, I sometimes have to stop myself and go, this isn't just some person and character you made up. So it's a really interesting book to read.
Yeah, no, that's kind of the great divide between, you know, historical fiction, you know, between, you know, what the genre that I tend to call it is fictionalized biography. So, you know, you are, on the one hand, working with the story, the life story of a real person, but obviously nobody gets that close in a biography. I mean, you're not actually inhabiting the person, feeling their emotions at certain moments. And in the case of Pan Yulang, especially, the history is actually pretty uneven. There's really only one source on her life, and that's also a fictionalized biography. So it's sort of, you know, you're talking layers of distance and remove. And, you know, I think you are going to be sort of perpetually caught between sort of the question, particularly if you're someone who does read a lot of nonfiction. I mean, I've had a lot of people say this to me, that it was almost bothersome for them, that they wanted to know, well, did this part really happen? Did this part really happen? You know, I think I can probably safely say that at about, you know, 70 to 80% of it, you probably cannot confirm happened, you know, and obviously the really intimate stuff, you're never going to be able to confirm, because that's pretty much pure conjecture on my part.
Well, for example, when she goes to the brothel and the young but older, already established, highest priced girl in the house, takes her under the wing and educates her. You don't know, for example, that they actually had a romantic.
No, you know, I don't know that. For me, it was kind of, a lot of this was just sort of looking at her work and noticing things like this. Clearly, she's got a very strong attachment to the female body, to the female form. There's a lot of just very open sensuality in her work. And she really almost exclusively paints women. She really doesn't paint very many men at all. I mean, I think that I know of one painting that's actually of a man. And I'm sure there must have been others, but, you know, she had 4,000 works to her name. But, you know, that I just honestly haven't seen many of them. So, you know, I guess that was part of the conjecture. I knew that, you know, she clearly is somebody who had a lot of sensuality, who probably was feeling very vulnerable. I knew that these kinds of relationships did happen in brothels a lot, you know, both in Asia and I believe here as well. I mean, it's kind of a natural sort of consequence of the circumstances that these women find themselves in. And it also was kind of like a way to create like a small moment of kind of hope for her, because, you know, it was just so that environment was so oppressive and so dark, and I just was thinking there had to be something that kept her going, you know, and that didn't,
right,
you know, kept her from being destroyed completely in so many ways.
Well, and it's realistic because, you know, you often hear of young women that go off to college or boarding school or whatever and experiment, or out of that feeling isolated and out of sorts, bond with, you know, climb in the bed with just to cuddle and feel family and friendship kind of connection. That,
right.
And it, you know, mm-hmm. it goes further. And it's not necessarily, you know, an orientation labeling situation. It's just sort of a, you know, very possible, real thing. So it reads real, but then I have to tell myself, we don't know that.
No, we don't know that. She certainly never confessed anything like that to anybody. And the biography, you know, that the one sort of other source that's out there, it's a novel called Hua Hun, which is what the movie is based on. And supposedly it was based on a series of stories that were told to its author, who remains anonymous. Nobody really knows who it was that wrote this book. But she somehow met Pan Yulong's daughter-in-law, which is the wife of her stepson, who told her these stories based on what Pan Yulong had told her. So, you know, again, like I said, it's like a series of sort of operator sessions where you're hearing, you know, someone told someone and someone told somebody else, and then it gets put into a nice sort of fictionalized and fairly sanitized form.
We do know that she was in a brothel, that she was
ordered. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was, you know, that was something that I think it both defined and, you know, I think it sort of amplified her fame and her sort of acclaim, and it also really hurt her professionally in a lot of ways, because people sort of tended to just think of her as a prostitute who happened to paint, as opposed to a painter who had at one point been a prostitute. And I think that was something she struggled against a lot in her life, and something I kind of struggled with in this book, because I didn't want to give those brothel sections or the prostitution undue weight. You know, it was very hard to know how much depth to go into and when to stop, so that she could sort of remain her own person, you know, and become a painter that was sort of uninhibited by her past.
Yeah, and that's something that, you know, I mentioned that I think we first discovered you, or you bumped into a Slip of a Girl blog first,
mm-hmm.
who then
right.
suggested Naughty Words, which is Silent Porn Star.
Right.
And we're a group of along with some other friends, that we watch TCM Silent Sundays pretty
mm-hmm.
much every Sunday. And there was just on this summer a couple of films by another, I would view her as a contemporary of Penn's, who is, she was in film, in a huge star back in China in the 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Her name was, now I'm going to have to remember that after reading the other Chinese name, I'm going to sound very white, Ruan Lingyu. She ended up committing suicide. She made like 30 movies in 10 years, roughly, and ended up killing herself, but largely because of the issues of Chinese society, of propriety, of what a woman's decent behavior was.
Right.
And in reading about her, one of the things, you know, was at that time, women didn't work. Their jobs were home,
right,
and to serve, and this, and I suppose if the family was poor enough, maybe they took in some cleaning or needlework or something. But really, the only jobs for women were prostitution.
Mm-hmm.
So when the movie industry hit Shanghai and women came to do this, just a few years before her, all the female roles were acted out by men, much like
certainly in classical Chinese theater. Yeah, that's true.
So I was reading this and I was sort of getting this sense of, wow, to go from this, you know, as you write in the book, the wedding shoes that her mother had sewn for her, preparing her whole life for a good marriage and to have children, to suddenly be thrust into this immodest world where children are the worst thing that could happen to you, one of the
right.
worst things that could happen
right.
to you, you know, mind-numbing, and then also that, you know, that she knew that what she was doing was not going to be accepted. That alone is you know, changes a person, and you know, they say builds character if it doesn't.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, that was one of the fascinating questions to me. I mean, as soon as I sort of found out about her and her past, I mean, the combination of the kind of work that she chose to do and her past, you know, it was just a really fascinating quandary. You know, what happens, you know, when you have this kind of a sort of a scarring experience, you know, and then somehow it becomes transformed into this really, in my mind, and I'm not an art critic at all, and I know other people have different opinions, but I find her work quite gorgeous. And, you know, to be able to take that sort of a life experience and transform it into something that's not only beautiful but also just incredibly daring, you know, was just fascinating to me, trying to understand how those two things happened and how they impacted each other. So that was really, really in large part sort of the genesis of the book was, I mean, you know, great, she was a terrific artist, and, you know, she'd been a prostitute, but I wasn't particularly interested in writing a book about someone who was a prostitute or someone who was an artist. It was the intersection of those two things that was so fascinating.
And I think you write in the beginning of the book something about that, about when she's going to possibly take on a new student to train in art, that she talks about how one of the things she does for them is lets them more or less have a storytelling session with her. Because she feels that's sort of something, part of what they come to her for, but that she doesn't want to tell too much because that's her mystique is all she has. Because when she went to France, I know we're skipping years here.
30 years, right?
Yeah. That when she goes there, you know, she's quite adamant about what they call in France a woman of three no's or something like that.
Yeah.
She was not a national citizen, so that was a no. She had no husband or lover that was backing her, so that was a no. No man, and she had no agent.
Right, she refused to deal with
this on her own.
Yeah,
and so these things are, you know, very telling. Sort of this sort of sense from her of just that action without, you know, your words behind it, but building it into a full story, but right away you go, you know, that has something to do with the brothel experience, because this was forced prostitution. It wasn't a choice she made.
Right.
And this is an exercise in control.
Exactly. Yeah, no, that was exactly the way that I read it, too. You know, and I did see sort of, you know, the fact is that she did control her story very, very tightly. I mean, the version that you read, if you read Hua Hun, and I didn't read it in detail. I got sort of a very rough outline from a translator so that I wouldn't get sort of caught up in somebody else's, you know, imagination and details. But, you know, it is, as I said, a very sanitized version. I mean, it's almost like a Cinderella story, that she's the scullery maid at this brothel, and for 4 years she's kind of just scrubbing the floors, and on the last day she's poised to become the top girl at the brothel, and this handsome official sweeps her away. And that's, you know, that's the story that was on record for her. And, you know, you realize that she needed to have some sort of control over her. I mean, I suppose it's possible that that's actually what happened. You know, the research that I did on brothels in China and brothels in general led me to believe that, you know, I think that there was probably more involved there. But, you know, you can't blame her for wanting to control her story and for wanting to exert some sort of, you know, influence over the way that people saw her. Both as a prostitute.
Yeah, I mean, if she couldn't deny that she was in a brothel because there was documentation proof, people to stand up and say no, you know, literally saw you there. The only thing you can do is control the things they wouldn't know, how much work you actually did, what kind of work you actually did. And that certainly, going back to that Chinese actress, I mean, it was very clear that the public reaction and the public perception and the use of media, you know, very strong at that time, very pervasive to these women that had been grown up to not stand up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the opposite of being a decent woman in China at that time was to just say, look at me.
Yeah, exactly,
you know,
to draw attention.
To go for a job would have been drawing attention to themselves, would have been saying, I'm good at something.
Right.
That was completely opposite of what it is. So being talked about in the media would have been something that she would have had no desire or familiarity with, you know,
right.
Other women to say, this is how you handle it. you know, this, you know, she wouldn't have had a team of people like today's celebrities, you know, handling media for her.
Oh, God,
so she would
no.
have
I mean,
had to, you know, create the story that she was willing to discuss.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I think that there was absolutely no media control. And, you know, my sense was that people just took her story and went wild with it. And the fact that she chose to, I mean, I'm fascinated by the fact that she continued to paint the kinds of very controversial paintings that she did regardless. I mean, that just shows me that, you know, certainly she was very strong in character. And also that in some ways, I mean, she was really just kind of saying, you know, forget you. You know, this is what I'm going to do. And, you know, there was a real, a very defiant streak that clearly must have, you know, gone, sort of run through her as a woman to be able to say, not only am I not going to care about, you know, what you say about me and my past, but, you know, just to prove it, I'm going to continue to paint this stuff, even though I know that it just makes you think all the worse of me. You know, I just think that was pretty extraordinary.
I think that she's a special kind of woman. I'm going to take one break right now to remind people that they're listening to Cult of Gracie Radio on XXBN. I'm Gracie Bissett, and I'm broadcasting from Fargo, North Dakota via Blog Talk Radio. However, we are officially on XXBN, which is a media project of Swap East, a sex worker outreach project, media project, and that is located in Raleigh, North Carolina. Tonight we're speaking with Jennifer Epstein, whoever we is. I am speaking with Jennifer Epstein. You want to be speaking with Jennifer Epstein, you need to call in.
Speaking with Jennifer.
It's so tricky. 646-200-3136. Or for the shy and phobic, you can type your question into the chat room here at blogtalkradio.com. However, I will let you know I am able to read questions but unable to answer them there, so I do keep an eye on it for the phone phobic. Also, tonight we're going to start a brand new option of you will be able to email your questions to me at gracie.pissett@gmail.com. If you're not sure how to spell cassette, Pissett, the easiest way is, like I just said, cassette, but with a P, the letter P for pan in front. So it's gracie.pissett@gmail.com. You can email your question in that way. Tonight I'm also, for questions that impress me, we're going to be giving away one of Elizabeth's books, The Painter from Shanghai. So if you haven't read the book yet and you're going to want to, you can get a free copy. Otherwise, you can tootle on over to Amazon and get a copy. One of the things that struck me, I know that you did a little brief interview over at Silent Porn Star, so, and I was reading there. A couple of things that struck me from there, one was this idea of, you know, my first thought was, you know, how would it be to be a painter? And clearly she had talent.
Yeah.
But there must have always been this sense of either completely written off because of the types of work she did or her own personal history, or there would have been, she's good for a painter who was a prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? There was that. How she would never live that down in her reputation, would she?
No, I think that was a big part of it. And, I do think that this is something that, you know, it begs a sort of deeper question of, you know, establishment. And, you know, the fact is that I think that it's a question that comes up a lot with women artists in general. And I wouldn't even just confine that to painters. I think it comes up with literature. You know, I'm sort of always bemused by the fact that people are trying to kind of put this book into kind of a chick lit category. You know, I don't see myself as a woman.
Really?
Yeah.
I wouldn't know.
Yeah, no, I don't see
myself. Chick lit, don't think so.
Yeah, I don't read a lot of chick lit. I mean, I enjoy it when I enjoy it, but, you know, it wasn't exactly what I was going for. But I think the fact is that I'm a woman, and I'm writing about a very womanly subject, and, you know, therefore it becomes women's literature, and by default, for some people, chick lit. You know, and I think that as a woman painter who was painting, you know, largely female subjects, you know, there was a lot of debate about her actual talent. You know, I think that part of what kind of saved her at this particular moment in Chinese art history was that you were seeing a huge kind of clash between modern and traditional. So, you know, she was really on the vanguard of sort of much more modern Western style techniques, although, it, you know, it doesn't seem all that modern when you look at it today, given where she was coming from, which was the traditional sort of Guohua Chinese, you know, sort of very, very refined, conservative, black and white, pen and ink types of paintings. You know, what she was doing was just really off the charts, and I think it kind of knocked people off balance a little bit. So, you know, she was modern, she was aligned with a couple very powerful, strong modern male writers, painters as well. So I think that was a big part of why, you know, she was given sort of more of a chance that she might have than she might have been otherwise. But having said that, the debate still sort of rages. You know, I had a fascinating email from somebody. I still am trying desperately to find, you know, cases of her work. I really wanted to get, you know, to come, go and see some actual oil paintings of hers. And there just aren't that many right now. Most of them are in the Anhui Museum in Anhui, China, which is the province where she was. And there just isn't much else. And so I sent out a sort of all points email, and a friend of mine, you know, is in finance, and he knows a lot of Asian art collectors, so he passed this along, and he got an email back saying, "I don't collect women painters, and I don't know anyone who does," which I just thought was extraordinary. I saved it. I was like, wow, oh, my God.
And so you want to write back and that you know of, because there's always been a history of when the, you know, male establishment says women can't paint, can't write, can't whatever, that work under male names.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I think that's totally true.
My wish to that gentleman is that he and then he wake up tomorrow morning, do a little research, and realize that 98% of his artwork collection was done by women.
Might actually be done by women. Yeah, I know. I mean, who knows? But it was just, it spoke volumes to me about, you know, the bias that clearly is, I mean, certainly it was in place, and I think it's very clearly still in place against women artists. I mean, not just in China, but I think everywhere, you know. I mean, it is a question, you know, you can debate back and forth. Is it merit? Is it talent? Is it, you know, what is it? But I don't think anybody can really argue that you know, probably the majority of the big painters in the Asian art boom right now are men, and the ones that seem to have the most successful careers are men.
You know, you can say that about most, you know, pinnacle success career sorts of things, except for in sex work. Those are women.
Right.
You know, but otherwise the top CEOs, you know, it's, you know, they're always, you know, excited when Oprah makes a list or something, and it's like, but she's there with how many, you know, penises as opposed to other vaginas standing with her. It's just pretty clear. One of the other things is that you know, here, it's, you know, because we're run by Swapies, and I myself am a former sex worker, you know, we as sex workers get a lot of flack for the, because we're all very much for legitimizing it, because we know it's the safest mm-hmm. thing to do for sex workers. And we're, number one thing is always about, you know, you can't enter sex work unless you can consent to it. There is no non-consensual sex work, because then it is slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a distinction there. So for me reading this book, I mean, it's not, it's fascinating to me, because, you know, she didn't choose that line of work. And yet through that line of work, like you said, she's mainly paints female nudes. And it seems to me, I'm not the art expert. I know what I like, but I'm not much better than that. But I look at that work, and knowing her history and knowing that so much of it is the female body, I have to say to myself, she's working on an issue here. You know what I mean?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Who does a body belong to? Mm-hmm. Why? I mean, I don't want to speak for you, Jennifer, but how many women have, you know, at the first time a boy made a comment about their boobies coming in, and men seemed, you know, boys started seeming to act like bigger idiots because you had boobies or hips or whatever it was.
Right, right.
That you started to go, what the heck is the big deal?
Right.
You know, and you started to realize you were vulnerable because of that, but you also had a power because of that, because mm-hmm. now you were desirable for this thing. And there must have been some of that for Pan to realize that the body was a commodity, that there was a desire for it.
Right.
For her, it must have been being forced into something like that, even, you know, whether or not she was an actual prostitute, just worked in the brothel, I don't know, but there must have been a fear and a horror and the vulnerability side of that. But there must have also been the whole, you know, there's power here. So in her artwork, I see her sort of going, you know, what is beautiful, what is not, who controls it, you know, trying to figure that all out, because some of her pieces are, like you said, very sensual.
Right.
Other ones seem to be like a giant question mark to me.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, some of them are almost kitsch, you know. I mean, the way that she depicts sort of, you know, women sort of overtly kind of waiting, half dressed, you know, at a table. You know, it's just they're very interesting, interesting images and interesting moments, you know, that she's choosing to depict. You know, I definitely had the same feeling that this is like, you know, I think part of why she chose, you know, to use this subject was in part because it was in the classical teachings of Western art. You know, the female body, the female nude is just one of the, you know, the foundations of Western art. And I think that she sort of embraced that pretty early on. But I think she also saw it as a kind of window, you know, through which she could start looking at her own life and her own experiences. And try to, you know, reclaim. I am interested. I mean, one of the things that, one of the names that was brought up to me as I was researching this was Suzanne Valadon, who was a French painter. She was actually Trillo, who was another French painter's mother. And she had started out as a model for Degas and a number of other very famous sort of impressionistic painters. And I think a lot of the very famous paintings that you look at, I'm trying to remember what the specific titles are, but they feature this one woman, Suzanne Valadon, who then somehow managed to cross over across the, you know, the studio and pick up a paintbrush and become a painter herself. And a lot of her images are actually very non-romantic, you know, that they're very strong lines, they're very fleshy bodies, they're not traditionally beautiful, you know, and, you know, when I was sort of comparing her work to Pan Yulong's, I realized that, you know, Pan really made an effort to sort of beautify the human form almost always. I mean, even when there might be a little extra flesh or things are a little, you know, a little sort of full and Rubenesque, they're still quite lovely. You know, there's beautiful tones and there's, you know, I don't think that there's really no ugly images that she painted of women. They're all quite beautiful. And I thought that was also a very interesting commentary, you know, that she's sort of very defiantly saying, you know, this is how I see us, you know, this is how I see me.
And there must have been something really extraordinary. I mean, again, I'm imagining, but there must have been something extraordinary to be her nude model.
Yeah.
I mean, if you were traditionally working with men who, from what we've read of actual biographies, either you know, couldn't help but having affairs with the models.
Right.
Or viewed them completely as pieces of meat to look at, no more important than an apple.
Right.
You know, one extreme or the other. But in either case, they were objects and not really people.
Mm-hmm.
And it must have been fabulous to then walk in to Penn Studio and suddenly, you know, she must have had a far different approach to working with the model. She must have done little things to appear non-threatening because she would know that that would be, she would get the most relaxed, the most real, you know, impressions from the body. If a model's sitting there and sort of waiting at any moment for the finger to be tweaking something it shouldn't be,
right.
Opposed to relaxing and letting your guard down. And the look on your face, if nothing else, would be completely different.
I think that's entirely possible, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I actually start off the book with this, you know, with the, I think you mentioned it's the scene where she's painting another woman, and I'm focusing largely on the relationship between the two of them because that was of a lot of interest to me as well. But I also felt that it kind of was a reflection of, you know, when you are being portrayed, you know, who's actually in control, and I think that, you know, my guess is that she probably, you know, the way that I saw it, you know, was that she involved herself in a real discussion and debate with her subjects, you know, to try to sort of integrate them into what the paintings were, as opposed to just saying, this is how I see you, and this is who you are, and this is what you're going to be in my painting. So
yeah, there must have been some sense of, if she was questioning what the body meant, was it beautiful, who did it belong to, what, you know, control issues and that sort of thing, because she must have felt vulnerable because of, if nothing else, the experiences in the brothel. To see a model, you know, in that position, she would probably think, I don't want to be the oppressor,
right.
Although she may have a goal as an artist of what she's trying to do. And I think in that beginning, too, there's something about the model says something about her thighs look big or something. And
yeah,
and she's
right.
Like,
she's
look at this line compared to this here, and it's the shape, and that's how a painting is constructed.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just your thigh. But then she becomes sort of not fully neurotic, but then she becomes, you know, rather concerned herself. Is this any good? Am I sacrificing the form of the painting or the form of the person? And I'm sure that had to, unconsciously at some level, have her be aware of who had control over this.
Yeah, I think that's true, and it's also you question. I mean, you know, to be honest, that was also me just questioning my right to be taking on this subject. You know, I mean, I was very daunted by taking on, you know, someone from a different era, certainly someone from a different country and culture. You know, I've lived in Asia, and I lived in Hong Kong with frequent trips to China for a few years. But, you know, I'm not Chinese, obviously. I didn't grow up with that culture sort of in and around me. So, you know, I did often sort of say to myself, well, why am I the one that's telling the story? You know, what right do I have, and how can I possibly do it justice? You know, and I think that in some ways what I was trying to do was play with that idea of the, you know, who's the viewer, who's the painter, who's the subject, you know, and
to what... It was your deep breath.
Pardon?
It was kind of like your deep breath for beginning there.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, no question. Okay, I'm just going to do this.
Yeah.
It's going to take me a while, but I'm going to do it. Yeah.
You're more of a research nonfiction writer, aren't you?
Well, no. I mean, I was a journalist for 10 years, but I've always loved fiction. I mean, you know, the example that I like to use is that I was working in Tokyo as a journalist, a financial journalist of all things. And, you know, my favorite time of the day was I had, like most people in Tokyo, I had like an hour and a half commute each way because it's just so ridiculously congested. And I just read novels the whole time. You know, whenever I was on a train, I would pull out a novel, and that was always my favorite part of the day. You know, and then I would get to the office, and I would start calling up, you know, CEOs and stockbrokers and start trying to sort of write about the drama of the finance world, which certainly has drama, but it wasn't the drama that necessarily appealed to me. So, you know, I did have a lot of basis in research, a lot of experience in it, and I had a lot, you know, thanks to my career, I had a lot of experience overseas, which I think was very, very helpful in making me feel like, okay, well, this is not, it's going to be challenging, but it's not going to be impossible because I have lived in some of these places and I do have a sense for the cultures, even if I'm not actually actively part of them.
And a respect for it because you've been around it. You're not some, you know,
oh, yeah,
stereotypical, I think I know it because I saw it on a postcard that my aunt sent me.
Oh, yeah. No, I haven't. Hopefully not. That wasn't the goal. So.
Book doesn't come across that way, but I've never been there, so I would, you know, I don't know. I'm going to mention again that if you have a question for Jennifer, you should give us a call at 646-200-3136. Another thing that struck me is she seems to have loved this man that, you know, maybe I should let you fill in little gaps here, but she was taken from the... She was paid for or rescued, however you looked at it, from the brothel by this man who did marry her, but she was his second wife.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how it works?
She was a concubine,
so that was,
yeah.
A concubine, but legally his property, and...
I don't think she was legally his property. I think that legally she wasn't anything, you know, a concubine. Mm-hmm. But I think by that point, because there was, at the turn of the century, China made a huge effort, as did a lot of Asian nations, to modernize and sort of adapt more sort of Western democratic, you know, concepts. And one of them was the outlawing of polygamy. So up until that point, it had been somewhat standard for wealthy men to have more than one wife. And I think by that point, it actually technically was not legal. But, you know, he did it, I think, just in form to try and kind of make their affair less scandalous, to try and give them both some sort of credibility. And so I think that technically she had no legal standing in his family. So, but I don't think that he... I mean, she probably...
A great affection between them.
Oh, absolutely. I can't imagine that there wasn't. Yeah, I mean, I think that they must have had... And that was actually...
She never married anyone else.
No, she didn't. I mean, she did end up, and this is not in my book, and it's not in the other book, but if you go to her grave in Montmartre, Paris, she's actually buried with somebody else. And this is the man, interestingly enough, who bears a number of resemblances to the sort of communist, the young communist that I have her meet and sort of engage with in Paris. She did end up, you know, as a companion for somebody else, But I think that that was always, again, this is part of the story that she controlled very carefully. And it was something that, you know, if you read Hua Hun, you know, it's made very clear that they're just friends, even though he was supporting her. They were living together at a certain point, and they're buried in the same grave. So, you know, she did technically end up with somebody else. But
was that while he was still alive?
Let me think.
He took his last name, right? The Pan is
yeah,
his name.
Yeah, Pan is his name. It was Damwon's last name. He died in 1957. So
yeah, she died in, like, 77, didn't she?
She died, I think it was 77. Yeah, I think that's right.
Remember, I'm always amazed, you know, when you hear 1920s, 1930s or whatever, and you just go back in this, you know, this time, in this place, and then you go, wow, they died in 77. That's my lifetime. The 20s seem so far, removed in morals and modern and, you know, not. And then you go, and then alive in 77. Hey, I was around then. How come I don't know of this?
Right. Well, that was part of it too. I mean, you know, but I mean, she did die in a fairly deep obscurity. But I mean, I think particularly with China, you're talking. I mean, this is part of what was also fascinating to me was that, you know, you're talking about just such epic changes in such a relatively short period of time. I mean, the country went through all of these political convulsions, and you know, was fighting two wars simultaneously. You know, both a civil war and, you know, a war against the Japanese, who are just constantly trying to take over the country. You know, there was just an incredible amount happening. You had, you know, people, forces that were sort of arguing for tradition and forces that were arguing for modernity. You had people that were, you know, trying to get rid of all the Confucian ethics and people that were backlashing, you know, to them and saying this is the only way that we can actually survive as a nation is if we hold on to these really conservative ideals. So, yeah, I mean, you're talking 100 years in China at that point was just an extraordinary 100 years, maybe more so than many other, you know, points in history.
Well, because everything that I've read since you sent the book, and I, you know, I was like, I should do some research first. No, that'll ruin the novel sort of aspect. but then I'd read something and I go, now I got to know, you know, how much of this is, you know, real event kind of thing. And in the accounts of her time in France was, again, that woman of three nose, that she didn't take on a lover there, that she seemed very respectful of her relationship with him and was loyal, mm-hmm. you know, in the physical sense, which, you know, I don't mean to be a stereotypical, but you got a group of artists and you got someone who's, you know, poor, who's
yeah.
literally the starving artist. in a moment of weakness, you know, whether you came from a prostitute situation or not, there just becomes these moments of, you know, a hot meal and a bed to sleep in. And
yeah.
peace for the night would be, you know, to feel less alone would be great. And yet there seems to be no indication of any of that from her.
Right. Well, I mean, she didn't even, I mean, I kind of created this romance because I could not imagine that, you know, here's a beautiful, I imagine she was beautiful. Again, this is apparently somewhat in debate in China. I had a funny interview with a Chinese reporter who was like, you know, did you really think she was pretty? Because people don't seem so sure now. It's like, I don't know, it sort of strikes me as not necessarily, you know, part of the question. But, you know, it is an interesting one, you know, given how beautiful her paintings are. But either way, she's a young, exotic, talented woman living in Paris in the 1920s. And this, you know, Paris in the 1920s was, I mean, it was crazy. You know, just everybody was sleeping with everybody else and, you know, affairs were going on left and right. I happened to know that, you know, one of her mentors, Zhu Beihong, was having affairs. You know, so clearly, and his wife was having affairs. I mean, it was not just limited to the, you know, the French or the expat community. So I had a very hard time believing, you know, that she wouldn't at least have been tempted, you know, by something at that point, just by the sheer giddiness of the era and the time. And yes, I mean, as I said, she was starving. I mean, literally, the Chinese students that were there were just starving. I mean, they were not eating hardly at all. So the combination of those things made me sort of think, well, you know, I think that would have been kind of a logical step. That was where I kind of stepped in as the, you know, the writer and said, well, this could have happened. You know, it could have happened. And then if it had happened, what would the impact have been on her art? How would that have changed her perception, you know, of herself and of her body and of, you know, these images that she was painting? So it's definitely an ongoing question for me was, you know, how much of that story that she spun for herself, you know, actually was credible. And if things were different, how would her story have been different?
Yeah, it's you know, it's like the thing when I read a regular stand-up, straight admitted biography,
mm-hmm.
you go, well, how much can this person really know because they're not in that head?
Right.
When you read an autobiography, the distinction between autobiography and memoir is somewhat, you know, blurred because we're human and this is how I recall it.
Right.
You know, I can swear up and down that, you know, I did this thing and it must have been around this time because it was before this and after that. But then someone
right.
can show me on a calendar, you know, and show me a piece of paper and I'll, you know, and I want to still go liar, you know, because
right.
the date's
right.
wrong from what I remember. So
James Frey, you know, that's
there are these ways, you know, we're human beings and what we choose to keep and how we retain it and what it means to us
mm-hmm.
is so different than just, you know, like, you know, teaching you history in school, a name and a date and an action. And
right, right.
And so in some ways reading your book was sort of like, wow, this is sort of, you know, not that much different in the lines of questioning because there are many biographies, especially if I read a biography on the same person but multiple biographies.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll go, these guys disagree over this event or this intent or
right.
whatever. And then you have to go with documentation, who has a letter.
Right, exactly.
You
who has the best proof, right.
Yeah. So, you know, reading this was sort of the same thing. It's like, you know, the fascinating things about people's lives are, okay, yes, we know she was a painter, and we know that she was a prostitute, and we know that she was orphaned, and we know that she was with this man, concubine, second wife. You know, we know those facts. Other than that, it's really all conjecture, and even when, whether it's a biography, a memoir, or a fiction, someone's
mm-hmm.
filling in gaps.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I think that part of what made it somewhat easier for me was that I also thought, you know, she is also an artist. And, you know, again, it gets back to that first scene where she's deciding how to paint her subject. I mean, she was someone who told stories with her paintbrush. You know, she told us about the people that she was painting, and certainly she took liberties and she changed things and she tried to create the best, most compelling, most articulate painting that she could. And, you know, if you look at all of her paintings and we're somehow magically able to summon up all of her models, you know, you got to wonder what the similarities were and what the differences were. You know, but her interest is really kind of in crafting a worthwhile piece of art as opposed to actually replicating reality. You know, it's why she was a romantic in her painting. You know, her paintings are all sort of beautiful. They create life, you know, as a beautiful thing. And that made me feel like looking at her paintings, and I actually had a number of them taped to my wall as I was writing this. I would just kind of look up and say, okay, you know, what would you have been thinking here?
And that's, you know, comes down to the, you know, the artistic response, you know, that you learn in college is you look at it and what you get from it. But that's based on your experiences as a, you know, not in your culture, not in your time, you
mm-hmm.
know. Well, the only thing you have linking you to her is gender, and then,
right.
And then, as we know,
as far as we know, right? Yeah.
How many women are on The View, and they can't get all agree? So that's not really a big enough "we all think alike" moment,
right?
I'm going to just mention again that you're listening to Cult of Gracie Radio on XXBN, which is a media project of SWAP East, a sex worker outreach project. If you have a question for Jennifer and want to get a copy of the book, give me a call at 646-200-3136, and we'll put you on the air with Jennifer. One of the things that I also read at that other interview was that some of the reaction you've had to the novel was that people think that you've painted, you didn't paint it, but you painted in your novel, you created an image of Penn as too strong.
Right. It was interesting. And not everybody felt that way, but definitely I got, you know, I think there's one of the comments that I saw on Amazon, you know, one of the Amazon reviews was that they felt that she was somewhat, she was very distant. I had a friend actually say to me, you know, and I thought this was really, really interesting, that, you know, they thought the book was lovely and all that, and of course she's my friend, so what else is she going to say? But
yes.
But she was just sort of horrified by the choices that this woman made. She just seemed so selfish, you know, and I was like, well, yeah, I mean, that's the whole story right there, that, you know, I think that she, as an artist, had to make these very difficult, very selfish decisions that I think a lot of artists have to make. I mean, I even feel to a certain extent, I make very selfless decisions. I mean, I'm a mother and a wife, and, you know, I'm on deadline right now, and my family doesn't see me an awful lot, you know.
They are being fed, the little children, right?
Pardon?
The little children are being fed.
They are being fed, yes. They absolutely are being fed. Oftentimes my husband or the sitter is feeding them, but I'm fairly sure that they're actually getting 3 meals a day.
Well,
they're eating them is another story, but yeah. But, you know, I think it's definitely like that people have a reaction to, I mean, maybe it's still just a lingering gender bias, you know, that this idea.
That's what I was going to say, because if a man is so dedicated to his craft or his career,
yeah,
that's just a good man.
Yeah. He's doing his job.
If a woman does it, she's selfish.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's true. I think that there's definitely sort of a lingering, you know, prejudice in that way. And it's amazing to me that here in 2008, you know, with all the benefits we've had and all of the, you know, the legal progress that's been made for women's rights, that you still end up feeling that you're not doing your job completely, you know, if your first thought isn't for the home and you know, and for nurturing. You know, and that's hard. I mean, maybe that's partly just a biological programming thing, too. I mean, I think that there is some argument to be made that so much of this is hardwiring. And, you know, and I also think that it's also very, very sort of, you know, built into sort of society's perceptions even now.
But if you had to defend that accusation that you made her too strong, what actions, you know, from a biography point of view as opposed to, you know, the fiction writer you, would you point to and say, well, this is a known fact that she chose X?
Well, I mean, I think it's definitely a known fact that she continued to paint. It's, you know, even the very sanitized biography that, you know, is the one source out there, you know, points to a lot of discord over her choice of subject, that, you know, Pan Zhanhua was not happy that she was displaying her own naked body in exhibitions all over China. He just was very angry about it. And you know, she did it. She just insisted on doing it, and it could not have helped his career at all. In fact, his career pretty much went downhill, you know, after her, as her sort of fame grew as a painter, his career did not grow. It sort of went in the other direction. And some of that might have been his political affiliations. But, you know, it didn't help. And I think also just looking at the fact that she, you know, she didn't have children. She made decisions not to have children at certain points because they would have, you know, they would have obstructed other things that she wanted to do. And she left him. You know, and that for me was kind of the seminal drama that, you know, I always knew when I started the book that that was the climactic moment when she decides to get on that boat and go back to France. You know, that's a gut-wrenching decision to have to make for anybody, and I think the fact that she did make it was, you know, something that people were very critical of and at the same time sort of admiring of.
Yeah, well, I think if you just lay out the basic outline of her life, as we've skimmed over a little bit here, but would you call it selfish for a person to want to make the choice? You know, she is a creative type person. She decides, and clearly her paintings aren't, wouldn't ever be put in a, quote, primitive class where you could say that she had no training or no talent. I mean,
no,
there's clearly something there.
Yeah.
So if a person has a talent and a desire to do something and wants to paint her own body, anyone, including a male, you know, that you have affection for and a relationship with, saying no, you can't, is probably going to be met by a, you know, if it were me, the bit's in my teeth and I'm pulling the other way.
Right.
So I don't know that that's selfish. It may be a tad reactionary in a sense, if you want to say, you know, based on the old experience, I'm going to pull the other way. But I wouldn't necessarily say it's selfish because it's a matter of pride and self-control.
Well, I think it's sort of both. I mean, and I don't think that you know, it's exclusive to the realm of women artists to be selfish. I think that artists everywhere are notoriously selfish. I think anybody who's really dedicated to their profession, and it doesn't even have to be art, you know, can be seen as selfish because they're making choices that are, by definition, largely about themselves as opposed to the people around them. So, you know, I think that on the one hand, you know, I'd be cautious about the sort of reactionary labeling of somebody as selfish because they choose they choose their goals and they choose their art. But I also do think that a certain degree of selfishness is necessary, you know, for great works of art to happen. And, you know, art has always, you know, revolved around these crazy, you know, very sort of self-oriented, living in their own world types of geniuses who are, you know, just kind of oblivious to the world around them and painting what's in their head, you know, and then the people that choose to be with them just, or choose to read about them, you know, just sort of have to accept that as part of who they are.
Yeah. So. Silent Borstar is refusing to call on the line, but she has emailed me a question 3 times now. She's sending it back in on the phone. So I'm calling her out as a cheater and phone phobic. But she said that in the interview you had mentioned that she chooses not to. She has an abortion, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
I can say that she phrases it all nice in here. Chooses not to continue a pregnancy, and I'm sure for some people that reads selfish.
Yeah,
and her question is, do we know that this is in fact a truth that she did abort a child or a fetus or however you want to phrase that?
The myth is that, I mean, you know, again, there's only really this one source in Chinese,
mm-hmm.
but it's in that book, which is also the book that claims that she never had sex when she was in the brothel. So, you know, I would say that it's probably a fairly good bet that something along these lines did happen. And this would have been a really, you know, a really sort of crucial juncture for any Chinese woman. I think that she probably recognized that once she had a child, it really would cut off certain options for her. I mean, the other possibility is that a lot of women who came out of the sex industry were unable to have children, you know, because they'd done so much self-treatment to prevent pregnancies that once they actually came out, they were unable to ever conceive.
We're also talking about 1920s, 1930s, or even a little before that, where, you know, who knows what they were, what old wives' tales they were following for this. I don't know, something about tadpoles in there, you take tadpoles?
Yeah, the tadpoles I actually read about, not in this book, but about, you know, other books about, you know, Chinese prostitutes. So I think there was a definite, and I think actually the weird thing is that there might actually be some truth to it. Like there are chemicals in tadpoles that are spermicidal or something. It's crazy. You know, so I mean, it's either she did actually try to, you know, was pregnant and chose to abort, or quite possibly, if this was her story from her own words, she wanted to also say that she was able to get pregnant. You know.
But it certainly wouldn't be a favorable thing at that time to admit to.
No. Although I think in Asia and in China, there's a lot less stigma attached to it because it's not a Judeo-Christian, you know, culture. So they don't have the same debate at all over, you know, abortion.
Just the fact that she was not legally married.
Right.
So she can't pretend she's friends with Pan or anybody else. By being pregnant, she has consummated a relationship that is not legal.
Right. Although I think at that point, I mean, the laws were just sort of, people were kind of bemused, but the laws were changing so quickly that I think that, you know, people were sort of not paying an awful lot of attention to them. You know, I think that you know, legally as an official, he probably couldn't have married her. You know, he couldn't have done it legally, but I think he also felt that, you know, he had enough leeway to get away with it, at least in form, and so he did. And there must have been other people doing it too. So I would imagine that not a lot of people were questioning the fact that he'd taken her on as, you know, quote unquote a second wife. You know, if anything, people would be questioning why she wasn't doing her job and getting pregnant, you know, which is what wives are supposed to do, and that's the whole point of concubine, you know, to have more kids. So
miserable failure as a concubine. That's an interesting thing. It took you 10 years to work on this book, correct?
Yeah, from conception, from the moment that I first saw, you know, one of her paintings to when it actually came out, which was this March, it was 10 years. Appropriately enough. So a decade's worth of work.
Yeah, does it feel done, or does she still feel, you know, you always hear writers talking about the characters as being alive for them, demanding that the story be told, or that they're thinking about them so much, you know, what their reactions would be to things that they would see, you know, with the character that they're writing about in their head, or order the latte or the, you know, double mocha. You know, does this woman still, you know, coexist with you somehow? Or is she
Oh,
not?
Yeah. I mean, she's very, I mean, the book itself, I mean, it's funny because I'm just an obsessive rewriter. So I think until someone literally just ripped the book out of my hands and said, we're going to publish it now, you know, it wasn't done for me. I'm trying to think, I think it was Picasso who made some comment that, like, it might have been Picasso who said, great works of art are never finished, they're just abandoned. And I'm not by any stretch saying that this is necessarily a great work of art, but certainly the abandonment is something I can relate to. I wasn't ready to let it go. It's still, you know, there's so many more things I could have done to make it better. And yet, you know, I do feel like, you know, my journey has pretty much ended, you know, with her. I felt like I really spent a lot of time just thinking about this woman. And she did become very real for me, and her work was very real for me. And I think that she'll always just be someone by whom I'm, you know, incredibly inspired and extremely grateful to, because, you know, she presented an opportunity for me to kind of explore my own art form, which, you know, in a way that I could never have imagined otherwise. So, yeah, she's still very much, I can't imagine that I'll ever sort of stop feeling her as a person in my life, but yeah, the book, for better or for worse, is done. There's no sequel coming. That's the other one. People have asked me whether I'm writing a second book about Panyu Long, and the answer is most definitively no. It's, I'm
not
done.
Unless something should come to light, right? I mean, if we discover the lost diaries of, then you might be a little more interested. But
I don't know. I don't. You know, I'll let someone else do that, or maybe make the movie. You know, I think.
I think that they said that when she died in France, right?
Yeah, in Paris.
That there was like some. You know, I mean, she was painting right up till the end, and she was even when she was so poor that she couldn't afford actual paint, she was watering down anything.
I believe that. Yeah.
I mean, I guess the word that comes for me through all of this, and so far, again, I haven't read completely to the end of the book. I can't wait to, when life lets me. But is tenacious. That there's this, and I don't mean tenacious in this apologetic victim way, which I think a lot of people, when they hear how she became a prostitute, whatever that life meant and whatever that word means for many other people,
mm-hmm.
it was something violating that of her choice that was threatening. That she overcomes this, but with, you know, but in a questioning sort of way, not in this whimsy, not in this who cares, but in this very, you know, strong but still questioning. I mean, I guess she just seems like tenacious. She's going to stick around forever, but also with that word penitent kind of coming from there, that she's not really sure where there is. It's just
mm-hmm.
not over there, and I'm thinking I'm heading off to the left, but, you know, the road turns and it looks good. But that she, you know, and I think that's the thing that I'm enjoying most in this book, is that it seems that while she changes, there's still this core person there.
Yeah, I think that's, and that was something I was trying to grasp onto from the beginning, was like, you know, she was an artist. You know, I happen to believe that people who are artists are probably artists more or less from conception, that you're just kind of built that way. And, you know, that was sort of the interesting thing to me. It's like, you know, here she is in a brothel. Well, how is she going to be seeing things, you know, from an artist's perspective? What is she going to be storing that she's going to be using later? And then how does that perception change and evolve as she goes through training, as she experiments with different forms of painting, which she did. She was a very avid experimenter. She did all kinds of pointillism and fauvist techniques and, you know, mixed them all with Chinese techniques. And, you know, she was just endlessly sort of inventive and sort of voracious with her art. And just trying to get a sense of who that person was from start to, you know, I don't go all the way to the finish, but, you know, to the point where I take her was really fascinating to me.
Well, I hope that people are listening that are at all curious about this woman's life or the time period or anything. We'll give it a chance, because I can't say enough about how great it is to read. It's not just that it's well-written, and it's not just that it's a great character / person, but there's something, there's this combination of sort of reading along rapidly, hungrily, like you do with fiction, but at the same time sort of thinking about it.
Right.
And going, wow, I wonder if that would be my choice, either as, you know, the writer is you being an interpreter, or, you know, Pan herself, would I have done like she did? I mean, there's sort of multiple layers in reading it, so I can't, highly recommend it enough.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
I guess, we're going to have to give that copy out to STS, because... He's the only one who was brave enough to do that.
I tried to get my husband to send in a question, but, you know, he's pretty much done with the book, too. So.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it very much for your time, and I wish you nothing but wonderful success with the book, and let us know what your next things are when they come out.
I certainly will.
Come on back.
Great. Thank you so much. This has been lovely. I very much appreciate it. And you have a great show and a wonderful website, so thank you for including me.
Well, thank you. I'll be in touch soon.
Okay.
And for now, I'll just say it's Cult of Gracie Radio, part of XXBN, broadcasting live from Blog Talk Radio, shutting down for the night. Again, my special thanks to Jennifer Cody Epstein, author of The Painter from Shanghai. Get a copy if you visit the websites, any of the websites, which I should mention, Jennifer Cody Epstein.
That is my middle name, actually. They're very similar. Yeah.
Oh, I keep seeing the E for Epstein, and my brain goes with Elizabeth. so it's JenniferCodyEpstein.com, correct?
Yeah, www.JenniferCodyEpstein.com. That's right.
Yeah. So you can go there and find out the book. Otherwise, cultofgracie.com, and I believe the page at Blog Talk Radio where you are listening live or will download this archive podcast has the book there and a link to Amazon so you can get it. No excuses, people. All right. There might be a quiz on this radio show. You never know.
Tune in next week.
A real page turner. Well, thanks again very much, and good luck to you, Jennifer.
Thank you so much.
Good night, everybody.